Hello and welcome to the Whiteboard Rugby Podcast, the Blindside Edition. And today we've got someone who is an ex-player, but perhaps more importantly is currently the General Secretary of the RPA, Christian Day. Christian, welcome to the show.
Hello, Sam. Thank you for having me. It's good to be here.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming on our show, Christian, and giving yourself to us at such a crucial time. And it is a crucial time. We were talking sort of off mic there about the potential of positivity within the game. I suppose the first question is just paint a picture from your point of view, from the RPA's point of view, of just how difficult it has been over the last few years and where rugby is right now. And I appreciate that might not be as positive, but where it could possibly go. I mean, I know that sounds like a massive question, but do your best on that one, if you don't mind, Christian.
It is a big one. I think the best way of framing it for me is that, you know, on an annual basis, we'll visit every Premiership club. We visit clubs lots, but once a year we'll visit and present to players and really set the agenda for the year and any big changes for the players. And, you know, those forums are pretty instrumental for us in how we go about our work. And I just remember last year, 12 months ago, standing up in a very, very different circumstance to the way I'm standing up this year. So it's certainly coming from a time of real challenge, and it's been really challenging for players. It's been really challenging for lots and lots of people in rugby. I think the repercussions of COVID, you know, really did harm rugby. I think rugby financially wasn't as able to bounce back in the way other sports did, or were protected in the way other sports were. So rugby really has suffered. I think that's for a number of reasons. But this year, being able to stand up in a very different light to players and talk about not things we want to do or would hope to do, but actually these are things we're going to do. And it all comes down to this new agreement, this new partnership that the game is hoping to make a really positive moment. And for the players, I think it really is a bit of a watershed moment, because, you know, if you'd asked probably 3 years ago, kind of pre-COVID, just about, you know, what would we love, it would have been the players being, you know, signatories to the game agreement was always the thing of the pipe dream kind of thing. But if you'd asked 3 years ago, I pretty much guarantee people would have just said, no, it's not going to happen. The fact that we're now signatories on that piece of paper is really important. It means players sit on the new professional rugby board. We believe we're the only players association globally who actually do that at this point in time. But we took a lot of inspiration from Australian sport, from American sport, where players really do have a seat at the table. They're partners in the game. Keep talking about growth of the game. The game needs to grow. Well, the best way the game's going to grow is by partnering with the players, making them part of the story, because we all want to know what Marcus Smith eats for his breakfast, and we all want to see the incredible game day stats and the on-pitch microphones and all these innovations that bring fans closer to the game, and it all involves the players. So, we're hoping it's going to be a big moment for the game. Lots of hard work to do, but a really positive moment from my perspective.
I introduced you there, Christian, as part of the RPA, and you've spoken there about the kind of player association. Just for people who don't know what that is, can you just give us a brief explaining on how that works?
Yeah, for sure. So all elite players in this country have the option, the choice to join the Players Association. We're not a compulsory union as some sports have. So the players have the option to sign up each year, which makes it hard work for us. We have, you know, between 600 and 700 members generally. It does fluctuate year on year. And essentially we represent players from the men's and women's premiership. We represent Great Britain Sevens players as well. And we essentially are there to support, promote and protect players. So we all want players to have the best career they can have and to perform on the pitch. But actually we want to support players off the pitch as well. We want to make sure for those players where things might go wrong, there's a safety net in the game built for them. So that could be things like insurance or mental health support. It could be, you know, off-field learning, career development. We have development managers embedded in every club who will just help the players with their day-to-day lives. Anything that's not rugby performance, they'll help with. And look, we want to add value to the game. That's ultimately it. And again, coming back to where we started, our kind of mission as an association matches up to what the mission of, I'm sure, the RFU and PRL would agree. We want England to be the best place to play rugby. And how do you do that? It's about more than just 80 minutes on the pitch at the weekend. There's so many factors to go into that. And that will, we hope, you know, retain the best talent, but also attract the best international talent. And that's part of our role and part of our value add to the game.
Can I talk about the actual PGP, the partnership deal that you've done? It kind of splits itself to me into four areas: the sort of international, the sort of top of the game, the domestic game, the academies, and then the community games. All of those to me seem a little bit interlinked. They have to be if you're going to run a process that goes all the way through. Can I talk about the top of the game and the international changes that you've made? A lot of people have been suggesting that one of the things that maybe needs to change at the top is who owns the players, and there was a real difficulty around clubs paying a lot of money for players who would then go on international duty and spend a lot of time away from clubs, and fans perhaps may have been going to Premiership clubs and be a little bit disappointed that they don't see England players as much as they can. How's that changed? Explain to the layman again. Myself and Sam know a little bit, but there will be people listening that don't. What's the PGP deal done for the top of the game?
Yeah, so it's important to start off by saying that the England men's team this year actually went away from the RPA in terms of their representation. So it's important for me to say that right away at the start. I don't want any misunderstandings there. But the premise of what's been done through the PGP has been relatively simple, if we want it in layman's terms. So as you say, we know there are anywhere between kind of 15 and 30 really elite rugby players in this country who get to go and play for England on a yearly basis. As part of the new agreement, I think everyone's got something from it. You know, I could talk about the advancements for the players in terms of minimum wages and benevolent funds and welfare advancements. I think the RFU wanted more control over those elite players, a bigger say in particularly their strength and conditioning and their medical care. The RFU will talk about the performance of the England team being critical to their organisation. Ultimately, we want lots of people who want to go to Twickenham and watch. And the clubs are coming, as we've discussed right at the start, a period of real financial challenge, and they wanted financial stability. So I'm not going to quote the exact numbers because I'll probably get them wrong, but certainly the first 4 years of the PGP is structured for the clubs to give them financial stability. So they're going to get a defined amount of money up front, which really should help them stabilise for these first 4 years. After that, it moves on to more of a profit share organisation. But like I said, everyone gets a little bit out of it what they want. In terms of those best players, you know, the best England players in particular playing for their clubs, you know, the international crossover of previous has been removed. So you're not going to miss those players through the Autumn and Six Nations. They're going to be available for the clubs. But what there are, particularly for us, what we think is essential are, you know, rest weeks built into the season for all internationals. That's one thing that I managed to get through the agreement. And it really, you know, the players are still going to be available 90, 95% of the time. But for those top players, and when it comes to managing their load, it's really important. There will be times of the year where they need to rest. It's not going to be excessive, but for us, that's really important for those players' welfare and also their well-being. You know, the guys aren't robots. They can't play essentially 47 weeks a year. They need times of rest. So everyone wants to see them play. I get that.
So I guess just on the principle of further down the pyramid, or I guess towards the lower end of the elite level. So this is something that I guess I've had a particular interest in doing the free agents list the last few years, is you tend to see a lot of these guys, a lot of churn at this level. What could those guys expect from this deal?
So it depends how far down we're going, Sam. How far down do you want to go? Are we talking about below Premiership? Is that what we're talking about?
I think we're talking Premiership, but the latter half of the squads in terms of how much playing time they get, perhaps that kind of on the cusp, perhaps of going to the Championship or having to look abroad.
Yeah. Okay. So look, I think the effect of removing those international crossover periods is going to change squad composition somewhat. I think that's natural in a salary capped league, and there are, you know, people whose job full time now is to manage each club's cap and make sure they're getting the best talent they can under that number. So, you know, for me, I look to American sports and I look at the way they do things. They'll always have some established stars who really do, you know, they attract a lot of the value of the cap. But at the bottom end, they'll have these incredibly young, talented guys who are just getting started. And they're vital for any team who wants to be successful. So I think it's quite exciting, this. I think the RFU and Premiership have said, you know, there's a lot of young talent in England. You know, the under-20s have just won the World Cup. I think they've been finalists in something like 7 of the last 10 World Cups. To hype that age group up a little bit more, they actually think this year's under-20s team will be even better. And to hype it up even more, they think the under-18 team that they've got this year is one of the best they've ever seen. So there's a real sweet spot of talent coming through, of really young, talented players. How do we get them game time? And that's really, really critical. How do you get exposure for the likes of a Henry Pollock at Saints? He gets enough media write-ups as it is, or a Finn Carnduff at Leicester, who is another incredibly talented young player. Are they ready for full-blooded Premiership Championship? Those two probably are, to be honest. But there's lots of other players who physically maybe aren't quite ready. So there's talk of what they're calling a rookie league, so an under-20s or an under-23 league, to give them more exposure. A lot of clubs have built really good partnerships. So I know Northampton Saints with Bedford, for instance, is really good. I know Amptill, for instance, have got some Sale Sharks. Caldy have got some Sale Sharks. Amptill have got some Saracens. That's the real challenge. We know there's real talent in the English game. How do we get them match exposure? In terms of your Premiership players, I don't see a lot of change in terms of your average Premiership player. That they're still incredible talent through the Premiership. And we started off by saying, you know, rugby's got bad news. I actually think rugby itself in England has been pretty phenomenal, like particularly the last 12 months. I thought that last Premiership season was as good as I can remember in terms of the closeness of competition, the excitement, the games that we had. But the off-field stuff is where we need a lot of stability and a lot of, hopefully, leave some of the bad news behind.
I just want to touch on something. Obviously, you know, Christian, I'm going to talk about the Championship. And I don't know whether you're the right person to speak to. And please, you know, I don't want to get you to answer if you can't. But when I read through the press release of the PGP announcement, I saw some really good news about the top of the game. I saw some excellent sort of, and there needed to be a realignment in the pathways and the ways that work around academy. I even saw communities being mentioned. The only thing I saw really mentioned about the Championship is about the fact that there is still a big gap between the playing abilities and the money within the game at Championship level, and that there was, I'll read it to you. It says, however, there is currently a major gap in competitiveness and playing budgets between the Gallagher Premiership and the Championship clubs. My question is a really obvious one. What are your hopes for the clubs to be able to bridge that gap? Because I'd agree with you, there is a bit of a gap there. There is disparity. What can we do? What can the English game do to bridge that gap and make the top of the Championship closer to the bottom of the Premiership and make the whole thing work better as a whole piece?
It'd be interesting to know exactly what that gap is, to be honest. Mm-hmm. I think on paper there is a substantial gap on paper, but we've just seen Ealing last week obviously beat a Bath team. Yeah. We know the likes of Doncaster are recruiting in a way that they haven't done previously. We know Coventry are looking very impressive, both on and off field. So there definitely are some teams pushing there. I do believe there is a gap at the moment, but I do believe there's an awful lot of good players in the Championship. The question for me would be, if a Championship team comes up, and there is the possibility of that this year, we have the promotion relegation playoff, which I think is a good step forwards, the relaxation of the MSC, the minimum standards, which is a good step forwards, and I'm hugely supportive of, because I'm personally a believer in promotion relegation. My challenge is, if one of those teams gets up into the Premiership is a slog.
Mm.
And I actually think their first 15s might be competitive.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, once you have a few injuries and you're rolling into February, or you're coming to the end of the season when your squad is really being tested, that's when I think there is probably a disparity in terms of that squad depth and that investment. Yeah. I'm no expert on the off-field. I will say that I understand that funding is much reduced now for Championship clubs. Is the RFU going to look to change that and perhaps invest more? I think they've always said 2025 was the revamped tier two that's been talked about for some time. Again, I can only talk about what I can do. I'm massively supportive of the Championship. I've said that from 2025, we will offer our membership, as I did for Premiership Women last year. We'll offer membership for Championship players from 25 onwards. We've put on the table what that'll cost, because I don't want that to be a meaningless offer. I want there to be support for those players that I think is right. And look, that's what I've said out loud, and I've said it a number of times now, so I'm not hiding from that. I think I've seen a few articles that are interesting, because lots of people say, oh, it's brilliant, the Championship, you know, it's Owen Farrell played in the Championship once, and this player played in the Championship. I think it does a bit of a disservice, because I actually think the Championship's a pretty cool league. And like I said, one or two teams I can see growing. And, you know, the Exeter Chiefs came up into the Premiership when I was playing. They were brand new and exciting, and now we probably wouldn't envisage the Premiership without them. I think, who's the next team to bridge that gap? I think someone will come along sooner rather than later. I know because of the people involved that Coventry, for instance, have got real aspirations and have a plan to do it.
It's interesting. I was at the Leicester Scarlets game on Saturday, speaking to some of the Tigers players afterwards. This was not heartening news as a Scarlets fan, but they were saying that they expected a big step up between Nottingham, who they played the week before, and the Scarlets, and they didn't feel like they experienced that. And so it's very good news for Nottingham. It's not very good news for if you're from West Wales, but there does seem to be that kind of feeling.
So coming back to what I said earlier about the young players, you know, most people's solution for the talented young players is throw them in the Championship. From the development coaches and the very experienced DORs, etc., that I speak to, those young players, as talented as they are, cannot hack it in the Championship because of the physicality.
Yeah.
I think we saw England 20s play Coventry, didn't we, last year? And Coventry's first choice team put 40 points on them first half. That under 20s team went on and won the World Cup.
Yeah.
It shows you that rugby is an unforgiving sport at times. And physically, if you do not match up physically, if you're not able to confront a team physically, you'll fall by the wayside. And yeah, the Championship is not an easy league, I'll say that.
You mentioned before, and it seems such a logical thing to do in terms, well, it seems logical, it seems simple, but then at the same time, when obviously you realise what it involves, it seems so difficult to effectively pair up or cousin up clubs, in a sense, like the way that Saints and Bedford have done, Saracens and Ampthill, Leicester and Nottingham, Exeter and Cornish Pirates. You see that it kind of works. Sale and Coldy, you see that it kind of works. There are a few outliers there still. I mean, unfortunately, Jersey were always the team that made that a little bit more difficult, and you know, things have happened that have made that theoretical issue disappear, which is obviously incredibly sad, and we never wanted that to happen, but in a way it works. It has worked in the sense that it is a potential possibility now. But I mean, is that a logical way, to a certain extent, to sort of see teams almost work together, coaching groups to work together, to have a through line, to have, because you mentioned there about you can't just throw kids in the Championship, you certainly can't do it without DORs getting enough of, you know, of them, or understanding enough about them as a player, and that through line thinking is really, really crucial to make sure that players are looked after and are catered for in the right way and developed in the right way. And again, That takes coordination. That takes teams working together and coming on side with it. Does that to you sound like a potential possibility?
It is a possibility. And as I said earlier, with a salary cap league, which the Premiership is, you're always going to have teams. They want to retain their best talent, particularly their young talent, but they want them to gain exposure. So it makes perfect sense for, I think I saw Bath recently have sent two players on a season-long loan, and that's what it is. They're not they're not going to play for Bath this year. They are handed over to that Championship team. And their development to a certain extent is kind of put in that team's hand. And like you say, you need at that point quality coaches. Those players need to be managed correctly. I've got no doubt Bath will be keeping tabs on those players. And that's where you need to work again with that word again, partnership. London Scottish have a very good partnership with Harlequins, where they have players with a heavy association with Harlequins are in the coaching team there. And some of their young players are starting to get that exposure. So it's absolutely. And that's where this, you know, the previous years, and it was probably a little bit before my time, but, you know, club versus country war, and let's hate everybody. It isn't really going to work because you're less than the sum of the parts of the whole. So, it does make perfect sense. What you can say is certain clubs have much bigger advantages than other in terms of the partnerships they can have. Some clubs have very close associations, a lot of history together, and others, you know, like you say, are out in the wilderness a little bit. So it's not a perfect solution. Bucks rugby as well has a big role to play there. Yeah. University rugby, you know, some of the Bucks teams are pretty handy. I know Exeter Chiefs invest a lot at Exeter, Bath invest a lot at Bath. So it's different ways of doing it depending on your geographic and where you are in the country.
You mentioned at the start, Christian, about how COVID got through, how rugby got through COVID, or perhaps didn't get through it so well. One of the challenges, I guess, that you have is that fundamentally you want the players who sign up to the RPA to earn as much as possible. But what COVID showed is that probably there was a big disconnect between what players should earn based on the finances in the game and what they actually were earning. Do you think that, first of all, how do you balance those two factors, the need for the game to be sustainable, but also the need for players to get paid a lot? And do you think that that has changed now?
Yeah, so we want players to be rewarded and paid fairly. That's fair to say. And that's why, you know, as part of the new game partnership for me, minimum wages for academy players was one of my headline things. It's like I was always that player who tried to look out for my teammates. It's probably why I've ended up where I am now. So it's not all about the top earners. There needs to be an element of fairness throughout. Ultimately, the salary cap in this country has a number of objectives. We want to be competitive with the best teams in Europe. We want to ensure that the best talent can play here. So it's not just a number put out there to stick under for any old reason. What I will say is that the pain that the players had to go through because of financial, you know, mismanagement or financial failings at three Premiership clubs in particular, the ones that I was involved with, showed that if you get it really wrong, then everyone's going to suffer. So there has to be sustainability there, but at the same time, I will always push that players should get their fair amount, and we've spoken about that throughout. We can look at the revenues that come into the game and what percentage of those revenues should go towards the players, the coaching staff, the professional rugby side of things, because ultimately they're the ones who will generate all the money in the first place, or the vast majority of it. So you're right. There's a balance to strike. I always try and be pragmatic and balanced in my thinking. If you go all in right now, give me as much as I can right now, you're probably going to suffer in a few years' time. At the same time, I don't want players to be taken advantage of. And ultimately, if players aren't paid the right way and a fair amount, then other areas of the world become enticing. And I come back to what I said earlier. We want this to be the best place to play rugby. Lots and lots goes into that. And the salary cap and the wages that players earn are a big part of that.
You look after players, as you mentioned, at the professional level of the game. But only if they're really lucky can a player play professionally for 10, 15 years. There's a maybe 20 if you're really, really lucky. There's a lot of time post the game to go out and become another human being. How much does the RPA get involved with that? I think I know the answer to this, but please tell our listeners just your involvement with rugby players for not the whole of their life, but effectively how you look after them once rugby's over.
Yeah, I think human being is the important thing here. You know, rugby players, as I said earlier as well, they're not robots. And actually, a lot of players who do try and be a rugby robot pretty quickly find out it's quite a dull and boring and uninspirational place. So yeah, I will actually say as well, I think rugby as a professional sport, and it is professional, has actually mellowed an awful lot in terms of encouraging players to do things away from just being a rugby robot. I think I think a lot of clubs, and I'll speak to their credit, I think Saracens were one of the first who all of a sudden said, you know, there's a lot going on off field that you can develop in as well as on field. So we try and facilitate that. Ultimately, it's an option. You can't force players to do things they don't want to do. And whilst we'd be really proud to say we've helped a number of players get degrees, we've helped a number of players get all kinds of qualifications. You know, degrees and qualifications aren't for everybody. Year on year, different things become popular. Is it coffee? Is it clothing brands? Is it people who want to write children's books? You know, we see just about everything. But what we will say is we'll always try and support that player. I mentioned earlier, every Premiership player has a player development manager embedded in their club. And that person's role is to help them. So we do all kinds of things. We offer education grants to players. And ultimately, when you're a professional, actually, that's the time to be thinking about life after rugby, because everyone wants to have a chat with you. Everyone wants to know about you. And of course, you can come and have a look at my business. And of course, you can do some work experience. And you're really, really enticing. I think when you've retired, and I found this out 6 months later, you're not so interesting anymore. And it's not so easy. So yeah, we really do encourage players. The players' training week actually helps it quite a bit, because most clubs will have they'll have a day off in the middle of the week, and B, training days, some days will be quite short. So, yeah, you'll find players doing everything. I mean, we had Finn Smith at our academy induction recently, and he's doing a 5-year, I think he said, economics degree, which I had no idea about. He said that week of the Premiership final, he sat an exam. You know, Manuel Feyerwoboso in England camp was sat a medical exam, I know. So there's all kinds of things going on. And as I said, we can't force players to do this, but the important thing is if they want help, need help, then we're there to help them.
Yeah. We spoke with Tom Tainting in an early episode about the positives of social media. He's over at Bristol Bears for the listeners. We know there's negatives of social media as well. All three of us have some level of social media following, which brings a lot of positives but some negatives. For players, that's on a completely different level. How are players generally coping with that? You see a huge amount of criticism of players, especially high profile players in international games. How do players cope with that, and what do the RPA suggest, or kind of how do they work with players on that?
This is a nice segue, actually. So we our academy induction at rugby school, we held it every year. We invite every single new academy player. They all come. And we do a day of kind of workshops and Q&As and all sorts. So we had Dylan Hartley there this year with Finn Smith and who else? Tommy Freeman. We had the Mark Mapletoft, the England under-20s coach. But we do a series of workshops. And this year, 4 workshops, 2 of them were social media-based. So it shows you the importance that we're putting on it. Yes, there are some real positives. There's the real positives of, you know, spreading your voice, using your voice, increasing your image kind of thing. But it does come with some negatives, and it's only going to grow. I mean, the young people of today, and I can talk about my daughter, who's kind of 14, teenager, always on a phone, exclusively communicates via Snapchat. It's a different demographic coming through now. So for 18-year-olds, you know, we did some workshops on some of the risks, and particularly I don't know if I should say on the podcast, they are sexually, there does come risks with using social media, blackmail, things like that. Mm. And then there's abuse, which invariably often comes from frustration, I think, of people, but the access you have now, you know, if Rob Andrew missed the kick in 1990, I'm sure you could have penned an angry letter to him that you put in the post. And nowadays you pick up your phone. Where's Owen Farrell? There he is. Owen Farrell, your XYZ. And then probably the day after, that person looks at a message and thinks, what an idiot. Or yeah. I hope most of them do, but you can just do it instantly. And it is an issue. We work with a set of solicitors called B5 Consultancy, do a lot of work, particularly in football. But they've helped out multiple players through us who have had abuse. And often it's a case of, A, get it off, get the abuse away from that account, but also, you know, getting banned. I know they've pursued people particularly in football, they've pursued people legally. And it's important for players sometimes that they pick up a phone, they're in a really horrible situation, and we can just say to them, look, don't worry, these guys are going to handle it, and they know someone professional is doing that. So, yeah, we're not going to tell players not to use social media. I think it's a potentially really valuable thing, but use it in the right way and make sure if you do need to get away from it, you can.
There will be young people, hopefully, young people. Goodness me. Can you imagine if we were attracting the young people, Sam Lana? Wouldn't it be great? hopefully young people might be listening to this. Potentially people who are of an age where they are looking at rugby union and potentially seeing it as a dream, as a career, as an opportunity. What sort of advice are you giving 13, 14, 15-year-olds about rugby? What sort of things can you say that potentially would point them in the way of what professional rugby is now about? Is there anything you would sort of, any headlines that you'd give them, Christian?
I'm very biased because of who I am, but I think rugby union's a fantastic sport. I think it really is a sport for all shapes and sizes. It's incredibly accessible. I think in terms of young people, I think back to when I was at school, you know, I loved to play every sport there was and had a go at every sport there was. And I would absolutely say, don't, as a 13, 14-year-old, just say, I'm a rugby player and I'm going to play rugby for my whole life. You know, go and try every sport there is, because when you're practicing your slip catching, playing cricket, hey, you're going to have better hands for when you play rugby. So try every sport and just know that one of them might just be for you. I think the allure of professionalism and being a professional XYZ is always really exciting, but that doesn't mean that if you don't make that academy team at 14, 15 years old, that's your kind of dream over. For some people, will play club rugby their whole life and it'll be their favourite thing of the week. And the thing they look forward to is going to the clubhouse on the weekend and they play a game and then they watch the Six Nations and have a beer with their mates. That for them might be the pinnacle of rugby, but for them, it's a big thing. You know, in terms of those academies, you know, I think of Lewis Ludlam, who didn't make the Saints Academy, I think, at 16 or 18, went back to his school, worked really, really hard and ended up playing for his country and captaining Northampton Saints to a premiership title. So it's way, way too young at 14, 15 to do anything that defines you. Just try everything, have fun doing it. What I will say is that in my experience, a lot of really, really talented young players get into a professional setup, and the big thing is you're not with your own age group anymore. You're a man. And Dylan was big on this actually at our academy day. He said, you know, if you're the best 18-year-old fly half at the moment playing for England schoolboys, whatever, good for you. But the second you go and step into your club, right, who else is in the room now? So if you're at Harlequins, it's Marcus Smith. Well, he's only 23, 24 years old. You know, that's who you're competing with now. You're a professional. Your job's there to compete with him. And the professional environment is tough. Like, I'm not going to go away from that. I think so what I said about Lewis Ludlam, like, he worked so hard. He was so professional, good guy, got on with everyone, but you knew he would do the hard yards. And that often sets people apart in the professional environment. How diligent are you going to be? How willing are you to sacrifice not doing something that would impact on your performance? A lot of people struggle with that element. But hey, at 14, 15 years old, you don't need to worry about that.
Well, we should end on that rare bit of wisdom on this podcast. I think.
I thought you were going to say it was a rare bit of wisdom from Christian there.
No. It is very rare. Very rare.
That was absolutely fantastic, Christian. We're going to watch with interest to see how this develops across Indeed. The season. As Sam said at the start, we could chat to you for days, but I think probably not in your best interest. But thank you so much for coming on, and I'm sure we'll lure you back later in the season.
No, thank you for having me, guys.